Well, good morning. It looks as though we are all assembled. Before we begin on this case, we have a couple of housekeeping matters that I want to take care of since we're appearing on Zoom. Attorney Roth, I know you're familiar because you've done this before, but the other attorneys I think are not. We will be keeping time with the assistance of our marshal. When it's time for you to begin, I will, of course, tell you that, but you'll see a green card up there in the left-hand corner says start. When you have 5 minutes to go on your argument, you're going to see a yellow card with 5 minutes on it. And then when you have time to stop, you're going to see a red card for stop. I will always let you continue to answer a question that's pending from a justice, but I will probably rein you in pretty quickly if you start down another avenue of argument. I noticed that we have an out-of-state attorney. Attorney Devaney, my information shows me that you've been admitted pro hac vice. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. I'm going to go over then, before we begin, the times that my marshal has given me that you all have agreed to. And if there's anything that's not correct, just let me know. So we're going to start out with Attorney Troupas for 35 minutes. Then Attorney Roth for 25 minutes, and then Attorney Devaney for 20 minutes, and 10 minutes in rebuttal for Attorney Troupas. Does that match what you think you all have agreed to? All right, very good. Then I will call our first case for the day, Trump versus Biden et al. Attorney Troupas, are you prepared to begin?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court. I am Jim Troupas, and I represent the President, Donald Trump, the Vice President, Michael R. Pence, and their campaign committee in these proceedings, along with my co-counsel, Mr. George Burnett. Big cases depend on big principles. Consider here, every vote counts. The will of the voter is a paramount concern. We should remove every possible barrier to people voting in our state and in our country. That's a really noble principle. Contrast that with the principle that the legislature embodies in its actions the will of the people. That in a nation of laws, laws count, and the legislature makes those decisions. What is particularly interesting is if one looks at the actual statutes involved here. If you look at Section 501, it says, except as otherwise provided, Chapters 5 to 12 shall be construed to give effect to the will of the electors. But then, if you look at 6.84.
Mr. Troupas, let me ask you a question. That section of the statute, 501, that of course applies statewide, does it not?
Yes, it does.
All 72 counties, correct?
Yes.
Not just all counties in the state, except for Dane County and Milwaukee County, am I right?
Yes.
All the will of all the voters, including the voters in Dane and Milwaukee counties, count. Am I right?
Absolutely.
And yet, in your lawsuit, what you have done here is you have targeted the vote of almost 250,000 people. A 250,000 people, not statewide in Wisconsin, but 250,000 people who live only in Dane County and Milwaukee County, two of our 72 counties, two counties that are targeted because of their diverse populations, because they're urban, I presume because they vote Democratic. This lawsuit, Mr. Troupas, smacks of racism. And I do not know how you can come before this court and possibly ask us for a remedy that is unheard of in American history, a remedy asking us to say to 227,000 of our fellow Wisconsinites, your vote doesn't matter. We don't care that you think you followed all the rules. You know, to borrow a phrase from Senator Cory Booker in another proceeding that had the effect of eroding the confidence in our democracy, this is not normal. It is not normal for us to be sitting here on a Saturday less than 48 hours before an election, before the Electoral College sits. It is not normal for only 2 out of 72 counties to be at risk for losing their voice in this election. This election is not, this case is not about election fraud. It's not about anyone in this state doing anything wrong. This case is about not just seeding, but watering and nurturing doubt about a legitimate election. Mr. Troopas, I'm very interested in knowing of one person in Dane County or one person in Milwaukee County who engaged in election fraud on November 3rd, 2020.
The answer to that question is posed in section 6.84 sub 2, which provides that notwithstanding 501 sub 1, the will of the voter, with respect to matters related to absentee processes, the provisions of that shall be construed as mandatory. Ballots cast in contravention of the procedures specified in those provisions may not be counted. Ballots counted in contravention of the procedures specified in those provisions may not be included in the certified results. I did not make that decision. Donald Trump did not make that decision.
The Attorney Troopas, let's talk about some of these provisions, Attorney Troopas. First, let's talk about this form EL-122. That's one of the forms that you're now claiming is illegal or improper in some way, because you're claiming that it's not an application. Can you tell us what's the title of that form? Can you tell us the title?
Yes, official absentee ballot application / certification.
Okay, so it's titled application. And then Attorney Troopas, that form, that's been in effect since 2010, right?
Yeah, it's a WEC form, yes.
So it was in place in 2016 when President Trump was elected, right?
Yes, and I believe when you were elected.
I was elected in 2018, but you're correct. So it's been in place since 2010. So yes, when I was elected as well as the president. But I assume if this form was so illegal and improper that President Trump would have challenged that form before the 2016 election, right? Did he bring a suit challenging the form then?
No, we did not bring a suit then.
And did you bring a suit challenging the form after the 2016 election?
No, we did not.
So what I'm hearing you say then is that really the form was fine in 2016 when it helped the president to win, but now in 2020, when he has not won the state of Wisconsin, there's something illegal or improper about the form. Is that what you're telling us today?
The form does not comport with the statute. That's correct.
But it comported just fine to help the president win in 2016. It's the same form, right, Mr. Troopas?
It had no bearing on his win then, one way or another. It was the ballot.
The same form, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And there was no injunction filed at any point by the president or his campaign, correct?
No, there was not.
To stop this illegal form?
No, there was not.
Okay, let's talk about this allegation about the missing witnesses.
Can I just piggyback on your form question? Thank you. Mr. Troopas, regarding the form EL 122, which I also have in front of me, this is a form that is used statewide, correct?
I believe so, yes.
So voters in, say, for instance, Door County would use this form, right?
Yes.
And they
may select other forms as well, but I don't know whether they use this exact form, but the type of form here is like many WEC forms, they're published, they're revised, they're changed. Candidly, I'll take back an answer I gave a minute ago. I actually don't know whether this exact form was used in 2016. The WEC regularly changes these forms at will. So, I don't know because the statute only provides certain specific ways on the form, I assume that a similar form probably was used. I don't know, for example, when the language was added that deals with application here. I don't know when the language, which is not in the statute, was added to that form that says, I further certify that I requested this ballot.
Well, Mr. Trupas, you have no reason to believe that this form, this EL-122, that this was not used throughout the state of Wisconsin in the November 3rd, 2020 election, do you?
I have no information one way or the other. I assume it was.
Thank you, Justice Dallet.
Sure. So let's move on to the fact that you're saying that somehow curing a witness address on an absentee ballot was somehow improper. Now, again, as some of the questions that Justice Crosby asked, this is a procedure that's used across the state, correct? Not just in Dane and Milwaukee County, the only two counties you're challenging today, correct?
Absolutely not. I know of others, and the record does not reflect that this advice that is given by WEC is followed elsewhere. While I know that it is not in the record that the other places follow this improper advice, that is not true.
All right, Mr. Trupas, you would agree that is, since 2015, across the entire state, that has been the advice given to 1,850 clerks across the state of Wisconsin, correct?
I don't know what advice was given other than the WEC manuals and the WEC forms, which have changed regularly, but the substance of this advice has been about the same, I think.
So the substance of the advice was the same. And again, so in 2016, did the president challenge this supposedly illegal practice that was taking place in Milwaukee and Dane County?
No.
And did he challenge it during the recount? Because there was a recount in 2016. Did he challenge it then?
No.
Why would he challenge it? He wasn't an aggrieved party in 2016, right?
Correct. That's why we didn't challenge it.
This is an illegal form? You mean to tell me that there's no method for you to – you didn't believe that there was a means for which you could challenge a form that was being illegally used throughout the state of Wisconsin?
May I discuss the Wisconsin Election Commission process in response to that?
I don't know that the process is really relevant of the Wisconsin Election Commission. I heard you tell Judge Simonic that their advice is irrelevant, so I don't know why process would be relevant to this.
That's why it's irrelevant, because the process that WEC follows, and this court held in the SIEU case, is of no moment whatsoever as a defense to illegal behavior.
I mean, Mr. Trupas, let's talk about this EL-122, because I am having a hard time. I think that a lot of voters in the state of Wisconsin use this form, and I'm certain that your client, President Trump, believes that many, many people in Dane and Milwaukee counties, the two counties where you are seeking to disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters, use this form. And I'm looking on the form right now, and it's a very detailed form. It talks about the date of the election in the county, the voter's name, the street address. It asks for a certification of a voter, a certification of a witness, a certification of an assistant. And again, the form itself says application on the top of it. Are you telling me that voters who get this form and fill it out are somehow committing fraud or doing something that is illegal?
They're not complying with the statute. That's correct.
Because that statute specifically says that there have to be two separate forms. I don't see that in the statute. Point that out to me, please.
Sure. Let's go to those statutory provisions. One moment, please.
Yes, as a follow-up to that, Attorney Trupas, I'd like you to show me the word separate. If you can tell me, I've read the statute a number of times. I'm having a hard time seeing it. If you can point out where that word separate is.
It doesn't appear in the statute.
So nowhere in the statute is the word separate, that you need a separate application?
Statute that you're referring to.
So how then are these voters not complying with the statute?
Pardon me. Well, to begin with, the statute provides that in 6.86 AR, that in fact, and I'm quoting, the clerk shall not issue a ballot unless he receives a written application. Now, when we deal with in-person voting, if you look at that same section,
Trupas, I'm going to stop you right there. The form I'm looking at, do you have a copy of EL 122 with you?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay. And can you look at the very, very top of it? There's a box at the top.
Yes.
Okay. What does it say?
Well, if you're referring to the official absentee ballot application certification, yes. I think I
just because you say it super fast doesn't mean that the word application, application, doesn't exist at the top of that form.
Again, I apologize if I spoke too quickly. Let's focus for a minute on the actual certification below, for example, where it says, I further certify that I requested this ballot. And let's also, which of course, they haven't requested it. The application has yet to be returned. Let's consider secondly, the sequence in which this occurs. The application has to be received before a ballot is provided. Otherwise, it has no meaning. Or if you want to read out of the statute, the provision that has the clerk compare the application under 6.86 to the ID being presented. Obviously, they can't do that. They have nothing, unless you're saying somehow it's the same form. Or let's read out of the statute that an application is specifically designated separate from the certification in the statute. You also have to read out of this that the application is kept by the clerks under 6.861, but the ballot envelopes are sent to the county. The only way you can read those statutes consistently is for there to be a separate application and a separate envelope. And the WEC has acknowledged this over and over in their own materials over the years. Of course, they change them at will, so that isn't unexpected. So, for example, they point out in EL 103, which is cited in the briefs, that these applications and envelopes are to be treated differently. One is kept at the county, at the municipality. One is sent to the county. In the recount manual, they specifically cite, they discuss applications and certifications separately because they are separate. They would be no meaningless otherwise. Then when they discuss the recount, the WEC again discusses them separately, and it never mentions this EL 122. They've come up with this argument after the fact. Their own manuals don't even support the proposition they're trying to make. Moreover, why would there be a WEC form 12221, an application? That actually is an application used throughout the state. You can apply other ways, but it's used throughout the state. And what does it have in the upper right-hand corner? It has check this box if you're voting in person. Finally, look at the record here. The record is that elsewhere, outside of Dane and Milwaukee County, they get applications.
Okay, Mr. Trupas, I'm going to stop you there. There is nothing in the record. I have looked at the record. You got in one affidavit from one clerk in one municipality. You're really going to represent to this court that nowhere else in the 1,850 municipalities do they use this form?
Oh, no, I did not say that. And if I said that, I misspoke.
Well, I read the record carefully. So tell me where, other than the O'Connell Law Clerk. And we're not talking about the rest of the state, though, right? You're really limiting this to Milwaukee and Dane County, right?
The legal issue at stake here is whether or not it is appropriate to read the statute differently in different parts of the state. If the application of the statute is to be uniform, as required, I think, by all law, then if the application is required, it is required. We have put in evidence, uncontradicted, that at least in Oconomowoc, in elsewhere in the state, people understood the statute and followed it.
Well, you put in evidence that another form was also used in Oconomowoc. You have no idea what happened in any other place. And let's just get back to what you're really asking us to do. You are alleging to this court that there were improper procedures taking place, yet the only votes you want to throw out are the votes in the two largest counties, the two most diverse non-white urban counties, and the two counties that had the most significant votes for Joe Biden. Is that what you're asking us to do today? You're not asking us to throw out votes in any other county that used this form. Is that right?
The recount statute provides in its particular. I have to explain.
Okay.
Because you know, you've made a statement as if this was a choice based on criteria that simply are not true.
Who chooses which counties to ask for a recount?
The candidate.
Right. So the candidate is the one that chose to only challenge the votes in Milwaukee and Dane County. Isn't that right?
The Biden campaign chose not to name the other counties. If this was a concern,
you don't know the names.
They could have named every other county in this state.
Wait a second. You don't know the names. I can tell you the names of all the other counties in the state. I'm not understanding. You have a choice. You had a choice when it came to the recount of which counties the president wanted to challenge. He chose to only challenge votes in the most urban, non-white, largest counties that voted overwhelmingly for Joe Biden. He chose not to challenge the votes in the other counties. Now you're trying to say that now you're limited to only telling us to throw out the votes of Milwaukee and Dane County, which you are, but the president is the one that made that choice initially, correct?
The president did not choose based on the criteria that you are stating in any sense of the word. The choice of Dane and Milwaukee County was premised on a number of issues. Number one, a Wisconsin Election Commission came up with a number of over $7 million for us to count the rest of the state, as opposed to the $3 million that it took the last time.
That's not in the record, but you know what? As long as we're not going to talk about what's in the record, let's take it one step forward.
Is in the record. It is in the record of the recount.
Mr. Trippas, how much money has Donald Trump raised because of the two-county recount in this state? How much has he raised? This isn't about the amount of money that this recount cost. This is about disenfranchising voters in two counties and only two counties in the state of Wisconsin.
I have a question regarding indefinitely confined voters. Please go ahead and answer, Mr. Trippas, but in the interest of time, I would like to address the other issues.
Certainly. The question of due process, which is what you're apparently alluding to, the Biden campaign could have chosen any counties. WAC, if it believed this was inappropriate, could have chosen any other counties. The numbers are what I said they are. Finally, if this court were to decide that it wished a recount to be done statewide, as we've indicated in our papers, we are more than welcome to do that if we don't have to pay for it. And it can be done between now and January the 6th, if that's the relief the court would like to have. That's up to this court.
Thank you. With respect to your claim regarding indefinitely confined voters.
I've just lost the picture. I just lost.
Hold on. You're okay.
Sorry, just lost the picture for a moment. I apologize.
That's all right. We've had a few struggles along the way. With
I apologize.
It largely works pretty well. So you can hear and see.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. I'd like to change the topic to indefinitely confined voters. As I understand the argument that you're making, it is based on the fact that there was some guidance that was issued on March 25th in Dane and Milwaukee counties regarding which voters could claim that status. And you are asking this court to basically toss the ballots that were cast after that advice was handed down. The problem with that I see is that there are people who were probably legitimately and in accordance with the law indefinitely confined. And so that would require the court to toss those ballots as well. I don't see anything in the record that would enable us to discern between the ballots that might have been cast not in accordance with the indefinitely confined statute and those that were.
And candidly, Your Honor, you know, 6.86 sub 2 sub B is the statute on which we rely here for the clerks acting on reliable information in order to discern that very thing that you're suggesting. There was, as with other limitations in the recount statute, but particularly with regard to absentee voting, the statute makes certain assumptions and then requires certain actions precisely because of the extraordinary difficulty, if not impossibility, to later examine each and every voter in the, for example, to determine whether they committed some type of fraud or other irregularity. So the statute makes certain presumptions. So our conclusion here was simply that as best we could, we've identified those people whom the clerks should have in fact acted as, we'll call them sentries for, looking into them and correcting it and making sure that they had not done that. They did not do that as to these particular voters, and that's the reason we selected them. But Your Honor points to a very difficult problem.
Can I follow up on that really quickly, Justice Bradley, and then I'll let you go. Just to follow up, you can't point to one person, though, in those two counties that improperly designated indefinite confinement. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Actually, there's actually pretty substantial information in the record at there was an affidavit submitted by Kyle Hudson, which had a number of people, I think there was about 10 in Dane County, whose their Facebook post demonstrated they actually were at various rallies or at weddings.
Okay, all right. So we're going to look at Facebook posts to determine if the person was indefinitely confined?
Well,
that's the kind of evidence. You can't point to one person, correct, that you know was not properly marking indefinitely confined. Is that correct, Mr. Trippett?
Actually, I just did cite to that.
Oh, based on Facebook posts?
Well, that's pretty good evidence.
Oh,
in this case, if they could go to a rally, that they, okay, they could probably get to the poll.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep that in mind as a way to use evidence in the future Facebook posts. All right. Sorry, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Go ahead.
Thank you. Attorney Troupas, the circuit court made several findings of fact. Are you alleging any of the findings of fact to be clearly erroneous?
I apologize, Your Honor. We submitted an opposing finding of series of findings of facts, and we stand on those as accurate. And to the extent that they are denied in our findings, I would say we do not agree with the findings made.
I want to be specific.
Yes, please.
Okay. The circuit court made this finding of fact number 34 and 35. The Trump campaign did not allege, and no evidence exists, that a single vote was cast in either county by an ineligible voter who applied via form EL-122, or that any fraud occurred relating to the use of that form in either county. Are you asserting that finding is clearly erroneous?
Yes, the first half may be correct. The second half is clearly incorrect. We as we pointed out in our papers and throughout, there was an assumption that the statute makes that in fact there is fraud, undue influence, and the like in the casting.
We're talking about historical, you know, we're talking about findings of fact, not conclusions of law. For instance, the finding of fact number 66 and 67, the finding of the circuit court was President Trump did not submit any evidence establishing that any voter cast a vote as indefinitely confined who did not qualify as indefinitely confined. In fact, he said, and I looked at the transcript and listened to the hearing, he said, I certainly could not strike those ballots based on an inference which is not supported in fact.
As I just indicated, I believe to another of the justices, we in fact did introduce evidence concerning a number of people for which there was a reasonable inquiry would have disclosed it. And I point out that Wisconsin Election Commission has no problem pointing out that if you misstate a witness's address or the like, the clerk is supposed to go out to Google and other places to fill it in. But apparently when it came to this category, they didn't feel that same sort of inquiry was necessary.
One final area of inquiry deals with the Form 122 and what's in the record. As I understand it, on the third day of the Board of Canvassers for Dane County, you submitted an exhibit of names that you thought were illegal voters. That is because of the use of the Form 122. And that among the names that you submitted as illegal votes, of course, was the name yourself and your wife. And so it just seems a little odd that you're standing before us trying to disenfranchise your vote and saying your vote is illegal. Now, I'm not saying that isn't clean hands, but there is a certain odor. I'd go to the nose rather than the hands with that one. You're here asserting that your own vote is illegal.
Well, in fact, it is. In fact, it ought not be counted because it does not comport with the statutes. I relied, as many people did, on the clerks to carry out their job and to not give me a form or ask me to do something that was contrary to statutes. If we think about clerks and we think about their role, I think a good way to think about them is a sentry at the gate. You know, if the sentry doesn't do their job, there are very serious consequences of that. In this case, they did not. They didn't, at least in Dane and Milwaukee counties. And that's the principle. If it affects me like any other lawyer, it affects me. It is what it is.
Counsel, I just wanted to follow up on Justice Bradley's question with regard to facts. This is an odd statute, an odd procedure. Most of the members of the court, when you came for us last time, indicated we thought some factual development might be helpful because of the competing questions of fact. The statute seems to suggest that, the circuit court should separately treat disputed issues of fact, as Justice Ann Bradley pointed out. We have some findings here. So my question to you is maybe more arcane, but an important one, which is, how should we look at these findings of fact? Should we defer to the circuit court's findings of fact in this situation, or do you believe a different standard would apply under Chapter 9 here?
Well, first of all, I think that under Chapter 9, you're actually reviewing the canvassing board's decision and not the circuit court's decision. The circuit court is in effect reviewing whether or not a specific finding or conclusion of the board was supported by the evidence or by the law. In this case, I think what we have is that there were certain findings by the boards, which then became ultimate findings here. And as the judge reflected, and I don't disagree with his general statements on this, which was that in our original petition, which the court couldn't know at the time, but I think now the record reflects, is that there's not a substantial difference of opinion between the two parties on the essential facts in this case. That was one of the things that we didn't know going into the recount, what in fact would be the kinds of factual disputes we'd have. But as the record reflects, as the recount progressed, we were able to isolate specific ballots and specific categories, and people were not disputing, for example, that certain ballots had been changed or altered. And they were not disputing that it was done by the clerks or, in the first instance, that the applications weren't submitted. There were no applications other than EL 122. So as to the essential facts in this matter, I really, as I felt all along, but I certainly feel now the record reflects, they're not substantially disputed. That's why earlier when Justice Bradley, Ann Walsh Bradley, was asking that question, I might have looked a little hesitant, because as to the essential facts here, I don't believe that the judge's opinion was much different than what we ultimately think, which is that the facts here are pretty straightforward, and it's the legal conclusions.
You're coming into the home stretch a little bit, so I'd like to make sure that you have at least some opportunity to address Democracy in the Park and drop boxes. Could you please?
I'd be glad to do that. And Democracy in the Park is one of these items where it's an obvious attempt to get around the statute that does not provide for advance voting. We are an absentee voting state.
Mr. Troupas,
could he just answer the question, Justice Kurofsky?
Absolutely, Chief Justice Rogensack. I want him to answer the question. It's important that he does. But I would like to know who voted in Democracy in the Park. These words are important. And if he's going to assert that someone cast a ballot during Democracy in the Park, I think that we, all seven of us, And the residents and the voters of this state deserve to know who Mr. Troupas.
Maybe he could save that for a rebuttal, with all due respect, Judge Kurofsky. Justice Annette Ziegler has asked one question during his whole proceeding so far, and she has a question pending. It would be nice to let him answer it, and then we can come back to your question in rebuttal if we run out of time.
Thank you.
Okay, so there are two things going on here with this. Under 6.855, a clerk's office cannot create a series of other clerk's offices. That's a sensible rule. And I don't believe, I think finally the Dane County has conceded it, they weren't clerk's offices. So now they call them drop boxes or human drop boxes where people could get all of this. But this court addressed that explicitly in Olson versus Lindbergh, back in the 1950s, in fact, where it pointed out where the clerks went out and picked up ballots from various people or delivered envelopes to various people, that was barred by the statutory provision that only considers two ways. You can return them either in person or you can mail them. And this court found that provision was mandatory, and ultimately those votes were not counted. That's exactly the same circumstance. I don't see any distinction here between what we have and that situation. Under 6.87 sub 4 sub B, those are the ways you get them. That's the way you can receive them, particularly if you're clerk's offices, and they didn't comply.
So, Mr. Troupas, just so I understand your argument, you are saying that even if people didn't vote at Democracy in the Park, we're to throw out those votes.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
So, did people vote at Democracy in the Park, or did they not?
People filled out their ballots, yes.
They did. I would like to know one person. I'd like to see one piece of evidence, something, the binders that we have. I have like three of these somewhere in here. Point me to a page. Point me to a line. Oh, point me to a person's name. Anything.
Well,
you know what? Point me to a Facebook page at this point. One person.
The reason I can't identify the specific people is even though that this was hotly contested, and even though the city of Madison knew every one of those names, they knew every single one of them. They commingled them with all the other ballots so that we couldn't do what you want me to do.
Thank you very much. We will now move to Attorney Roth. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Colin Roth on behalf of the Wisconsin Elections Commission and Commissioner Ann Jacobs. Before I begin my presentation, I'd like to quickly address a housekeeping matter, specifically the division of labor between myself and my co-counsel, Mr. Devaney.
Okay.
I intend to address the four substantive state election law issues that are presented here, and then my co-counsel, Mr. Devaney, intends to address all other topics raised, and that includes the available remedies under Section 9.01, due process, latches, and equal protection. And so I respectfully ask, with this court's indulgence, that questions about the substantive state law issues be addressed to myself, and then questions about those other topics be addressed to Mr. Devaney.
Thank you. That's helpful to us. Thank you.
Very good, Madam Chief Justice. Thank you. So with that, I would like to address the four absentee voting practices that are at issue here, all of which were considered and addressed in public guidance issued by the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission before the November 2020 election. And I'd like to take the four issues in descending order based on the number of votes that are affected here. Mm-hmm. So that leads us first to the issue of in-person absentee voting by written application. And I think as a number of the justices recognize, this is a relatively simple question. The form that is undisputed that these voters filled out says it's an application. They entered in all the information required and then received a ballot and voted it. And I believe that's all that Wisconsin Statute 6.86 sub 1 AR requires, 1A and 1 AR require. The response that I heard from Mr. Troupas is essentially a question about sequencing. What is the order in which this happens in in-person absentee voting, and somehow the sequencing means that there must be a separate application and certificate, which, of course, as Justice Dallet recognized, the word separate does not appear anywhere in the statutes. And so to address that sequencing issue, I think it is helpful to review the record and review some of the affidavits that are in the record submitted by voters in Madison and Milwaukee. And I'd like to take just one as an example, and that's Madison voter Megan Spicer. And her affidavit is found in Defendant's Appendix 10. And what Ms. Spicer helpfully describes is the procedure that happens when you show up at a clerk's office to vote absentee. And so Ms. Spicer, what she did is she showed up in Madison at the clerk's office, gave her name and address to the clerk. The clerk confirmed that she appeared in the state's voter registration database. Ms. Spicer then showed her photo identification to confirm who she was. At that point, the clerk gave her the combined application certification form that's at issue here. And then I think what happened next is crucial. What Ms. Spicer says is she filled out the application portion of that combined form. That's again EL 122 at Defendant's Appendix 7. She filled out the application portion of that form, returned it to the clerk, who then handed her a ballot. After she received the ballot, she took it, she voted it, she brought it back to the clerk's table, folded it, placed it in the envelope in the clerk's presence, and then filled out the certification part of the envelope. And after that, the clerk witnessed it, as is entirely proper, and then secured the voted ballot. And so I think that is entirely consistent with the sequencing that Mr. Troupas has offered here. And his theory that these need to be separate documents is just simply not borne out by the facts and how these are actually used in Madison and Milwaukee County. And the only other argument I heard on this point is this retention issue about how, municipal clerk must retain the application, and somehow that is incompatible, I guess, with the duty to submit it on the evening of election day to the county clerk for processing. And all I'd say on that point is a retention requirement statute is satisfied if the document is in fact retained. The statute does not say that the applications have to sit in the clerk's drawer or in their office. I mean, I think about my own case files, which I don't keep in my office, even though they're subject to case retention policy. I send them to an offsite. Facility, my office would be full.
Counsel, before we start talking about your case files, I'm mindful of the time limits that you have. And so I'd like to be helpful in directing your attention toward those issues that I think
are probably most, at least good.
In my mind. I won't speak for my colleagues, but they can jump in if they disagree. As I look at the posture of this case, we are being asked to consider whether certain ballots conformed or didn't conform with the law, and the ultimate remedy that the president is seeking is to have those ballots or those votes that were cast to be disqualified or not counted. So is it your understanding that in order for the court to consider what the president is asking for as far as relief, we do have to decide each of the claims as a matter of law? We need to interpret each of the statutes that the president is invoking as a basis for the relief he is requesting.
I think that's right, Justice Bradley. I mean, you obviously don't get to a remedial issue until you've decided whether there's been a violation of the statutes. I mean, it's obviously our position, and I do think we're correct that there were no violations in any of these four categories.
Can I interrupt?
I'm done.
I didn't want to cut you off, but again, I'm very mindful of the limits on your time, and I would like to get to the heart of the issues, having established that as a preliminary matter. One of the issues that I'm personally focused on is 687-6D, and that relates to the witness certifications on the absentee ballot envelopes, and the claims relate to missing witness addresses and what authority the clerk's offices may have had or not had to correct or add missing information. Can you please focus your arguments on what in the statutes would allow, if anything, would allow the clerks to supply that missing information?
Of course, Your Honor. So the first thing I do want to make just crystal clear here before talking about this issue is these markings on, these were markings on absentee ballot envelopes. These were not alterations to ballots themselves. I just think as a matter of fact, that needs to be crystal clear. We are not talking about clerks manipulating ballots themselves. These are markings on the envelope. So I just want to make sure we all are on the same page before.
I'm on the same page with you.
Very good. So the first thing I'd say in response to Your Honor's question is, and I don't want you to please hear me out on this, address is undefined in the statute. It is not, the statute does not expressly require absentee voter witnesses to fill out every jot and tittle of their address, including their street address, their city, their zip code, and the state. And I do think that is important, and I'll explain why. I do think if you look at other provisions of the Elections Code in Chapter 6, the legislature is very specific when it chooses to require specific pieces of address information to be given. The first place I'd refer Your Honor to is 6.34 sub 3 sub B sub 2, which relates to the proof of elector residence, proof of the elector's residence. And that provision requires a, quote, complete residential address, including a numbered street address, if any, and the name of a municipality. And I think that's important to note. It does not mention the zip code. It does not mention the state. And that's in that provision, it's called a complete residential address, which is a different term than what is required for the absentee witness address. It just says address in that provision. And I do think it's important to draw these distinctions, because the only way you get to these ballots not counting is if the address is missing. But if the address is complete with simply a street address, there's no basis to throw out these ballots, regardless of what the clerks did. If the street address is enough, that ballot is complete when it comes into the clerk's office, and it's complete no matter what the clerk does. And so I think that's very important.
Let me just follow up briefly on that, because assuming you're correct and assuming that's all it requires, why then are the clerks filling in that area of the envelope? Why are they filling in information if they're perfectly fine on their own? And where in the statute are they given that authority?
Thank you, Justice Ziegler. I think the reason they're doing it, and again, I think this is why it's permissible, is the extra information, I think it's critical to recognize, is not sworn by anyone. If you look at what 6.87 sub 2 requires, it does not require the witness to swear to the address that they write down. All the witness swears to is that the voter who cast the ballot that they're witnessing essentially is who they said they were and lives where they said they live. That's what the witness swears to. What the witness then does is write down their address, such that it's essentially a tool so that if we need to go find that witness to probe the certification to confirm whether the voter was indeed eligible, we can find that witness. That's what it's for. It's a tool to locate the witness in case they're needed for future testimony. And so it's not an eligibility requirement to be a witness. You don't have to live anywhere in particular to be a witness. All you need to be is an adult U.S. citizen. That's it. And so when we think about what it's used
for, in Wisconsin, absentee voting is considered a privilege, right? So if you choose to vote absentee, there are certain statutory requirements that must be met for you to be able to vote in that manner, right?
I think that's correct, yes.
Okay, so when you must have a witness verify that you are who you say you are and that you live where you say you live, is it too much to ask that that witness put down their address such that they could be found if necessary? Isn't that just what the statutes require? They don't require any action by the clerk, right?
Well, they don't, but I think what we have here is the record shows that many of these ballots that are in this category that the plaintiff has challenged indeed had, for instance, just a street address already on the envelope. And so I think in the main, what happened here was that clerks added, say, the state or, say, the zip code. And I think if we recognize that the purpose of this address requirement, which again is undefined, the legislature did not specify what elements are needed. And I would also point you just again on this topic to 6.18, which is a provision that governs certifications for former Wisconsin residents who nevertheless still are eligible to vote in Wisconsin. That statute separately uses the words address, city, state, and zip code in the same sentence. And so I think these statutes, 6.34, which I mentioned earlier, and 6.18, which I just mentioned, make clear that when the legislature means to require specific address information, it says it in the statute. And 6.87 sub 2 sets out the form for the witness certification. And that form simply says address. And I think this all reflects, what Your Honor is getting at, which is that the purpose of this, again, is to be able to contact the witness. And if a street address is there, the clerks may enter in the city and state, for ease of future use if they need to contact that witness to confirm the information to which they swore, which again is not the address. I would point out if the address had to be sworn, this might be a different issue, but to be clear, it's not.
If the WEC gives advice contrary to the language of the statute, which should control?
The statute controls, Your Honor, but I believe that every piece of guidance that we're talking about here does conform to the statutes. I think this piece of it does. I think clearly the application issue does. But clearly the statute controls, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd like to talk about a statute that troubles me. It's 6.874B. And that section requires that the envelopes containing the ballot shall be mailed to the elector and or delivered in person to the municipal clerk who issued the ballots. So here we have people putting ballots in drop boxes. We have parties in the park where people are being witnessed there by someone who is available, and those ballots are being collected, but they're not being delivered in person to the clerk, and they're not being mailed. And that frankly troubles me. I don't see how that fits within the statute. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Of course. The first thing, again, is a factual point I believe needs to be emphasized. We are not talking about drop boxes in this case. The plaintiff has not challenged the use of drop boxes, of which there were, of course, many, aside from what has colloquially been called the democracy in the park. There have been challenges to drop boxes in other cases, but as I understand the claim here, it is simply a challenge to the democracy in the park event, which I think has some very important factual attributes that answer Your Honor's question. I think, again, the relevant statute here is 6.87 sub 4 sub B sub 1, which, as Your Honor correctly notes, requires the absentee ballot envelope to be either mailed by the elector or delivered in person to the municipal clerk.
Right.
And I think if you look at the facts of what happened at Democracy in the Park, the in-person prong of that statute was satisfied, because what happens at Democracy in the Park, again, is a factual matter. I think it's very important to emphasize there were no ballots given out to voters at this event. It was simply a collection event. All that happened is people, the agents of the Madison City Clerk were present at these events and collected ballots. And I think that satisfies.
Oh, I don't think so. Otherwise, you'd have to say this is which Madison could have done, an alternate absentee ballot site under 6.855, and you have declined to assert that, and the city itself said, no, that's not what it was. So they're not delivering it to the clerk. They're delivering it to agents of the clerk that are set out in the park, but they're not delivering it to the clerk in the context of 6.874B1.
So I have two responses, Your Honor. First is, I think clearly delivery to agents of the clerk has to be permitted because that's what happens even at the office of the clerk. There's one city clerk for Madison, Mary Beth Witzel Bell. And I promise you that not every single person who returned a ballot in Madison hand delivered that ballot to Mary Beth.
But counsel, reading the statute in context, don't you agree that what is set out there contemplates, it says mailing it to the clerk who gave out the ballot or delivering it to the clerk who issued the ballot? And that contemplates the clerk's office from where these are sent out. Certainly not apparent to me in the statute that you could set up a clerk here, there, and everywhere and say you're having the clerk's office unless they decide to use the separate alternate provisions in the statute, which could have been done, but we're not here.
And just to piggyback on that, how many offices can a clerk have set up at the same time?
So I have two responses. First is the idea that by saying in-person delivery to the municipal clerk necessarily means in-person delivery to the clerk's office. And I think that's not what the statute expressly says. And I think that is an important difference because the legislature knew how to specify the clerk's office. And I think you can look at least two other provisions that I've seen in Chapter 6 that specifically reference activity that is supposed to take place at the office of the clerk. And that's 6.86 sub 1 sub A sub 2 and 6.87 sub 3 sub A. And I think both of those statutes expressly refer to the office of the clerk as a place that something needs to happen. And so when 6.87 sub 4B1 simply says in person to the municipal clerk, it doesn't necessarily envision, and I will get to your Honor's question about 6.855, I promise, but okay. I just want to tie off 6.87 here very quickly. So when 6.87 just says delivery in person to the municipal clerk, I think that has to mean there's no specific place as long as the in-person delivery is occurring to either the clerk or an agent of the clerk. And an agent, it just simply has to be okay, given how government operates. So I'd like to then turn to 6.855, which is Your Honor's second and Justice Ziegler's second line of questioning about the alternate absentee ballot sites. And I think this one, you really need to look very closely at the language of the statute, because I think what's at issue here, if you examine the language, are sites where you can both request an absentee ballot, vote an absentee ballot, and return the ballot all in the same place. And I think there are at least three places that show you that in the text of that statute. So in the first sentence of 6.855 sub 1 reads that essentially an alternate absentee ballot site is a place where, quote, electors of the municipality may request and vote absentee ballots and to which voted absentee ballots shall be returned. And I think those and connectors are very important. I mean, they're grammatically critical, and they indicate that these alternate sites are places where all those things need to happen. It has to be requesting, voting, and returning. And if you don't have all three, it's not an alternate ballot site. It doesn't need to be designated by the county board or anyone else.
No, so, I agree with you. I don't think it's an alternate ballot site either.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, Your Honor. It's not an absentee ballot site. It doesn't. And I would just point to one other piece of the language. Well, I guess let me try that a different way. What I'm saying is it doesn't have to follow the 6.855 procedures because it doesn't have the three attributes of an absentee ballot.
You can't provide a ballot as well as collect.
Right. And that's not what happens at Democracy in the right. Park. There was no ballots given out.
My concern is that this is early voting, okay? It happened way before October 20th when in-person early voting could start. Here, people brought their ballots. Somebody witnessed the ballots for them, and they collected the voted ballots. It's very much the same thing that applies if you do in-person voting. When you go within the provision about 2 weeks before the election, I think, When you go there, you get your ID checked, you get a ballot, you vote it, it's witnessed, and it's collected all at once. I understand that they didn't provide ballots, but the people still voted them with a witness, and the ballots were gone. Their vote was done at that point.
So, Your Honor, I have two responses. First is that I think the lack of ballots being given out is really crucial here, because that is an essential element of how the legislature has defined in-person absentee voting.
Let me ask you this question. Just say there's an elector and he gets a ballot, but he doesn't know anybody. He lives all by himself. So a week before the election, he goes into the clerk's office and says, I want to vote, but I don't have anybody to be my witness. Would you be my witness? Clerk says, sure. So he votes and he gives it to the clerk. Has he voted?
Well, he's certainly voted, but not in the sense that that had to happen at a designated ultimate.
But he voted in person, correct? He voted in person, just like the people who got their ballots sent to them and brought them to Democracy in the Park. He did the same thing, and that was a vote. He voted.
So I think what Your Honor is really focusing on is the witnessing portion as being, you know, troubling to Your Honor.
And well, it's critical to have a ballot that is a valid ballot that's cast, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. Sure. But what I would say is that, in-person absentee voting is not a colloquial term. It's a term. It's a precise term used by the statutes. And so, you know, the fact that, and I think you have to look at 6855, because I really think 6855 tells you when a place that you are, you know, doing some voting related activity at, for lack of a better phrase, if I could come up with something more articulate, but when it needs to be something that is designated in the procedure set out in 6855. And because there's no giving out of ballots, I think it doesn't need to follow those procedures. And I think all it needs to do is satisfy 6.874B1, which just requires in-person delivery. And so the last thing I'd say is, if it's the witnessing portion that's concerning to Your Honor, that did not happen for all these ballots at Democracy in the Park. I mean,
happened for some and not others. It's something I didn't know about till I read the record and the affidavit that's in there.
That's true, Your Honor, but if you take away witnessing, which certainly is not every ballot at issue here, some of the ballots were simply dropped off.
Right.
They were filled out, they were sealed, signed, delivered, you know, witnessed by your wife or husband or whoever else lives at home with you.
I understand.
And then dropped off. And some of the ballots in that bucket fit into that category. And so I frankly don't
see the difference between my example of the guy that gets a ballot at home and doesn't have anybody to witness him and goes into the clerk's office and has them witness it and gives it to the clerk and the person that does the same thing in Madison in the Park.
My only response I can give you, I see my time is up.
You can finish just that question though.
Sure. The only thing I can say is I think if you look at 6874B1, if you don't meet the criteria under 6855 for an alternate absentee ballot site, if you don't fall under that provision, all you have to do is satisfy 6874B1. And I think in-person hand delivery to an agent of the clerk is enough. And I know I'm out of time. I would just say indefinite confinement. There's no proof of a single voter, which I think the court recognizes that didn't qualify for that status. And so there's just no basis to throw out a single vote in that category. So with that, if there are no further questions, I'll turn it over to my co-counsel, Mr. Devaney.
Yes,
thank you very much for your time.
Attorney Devaney, are you ready to proceed?
I am ready. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. You. And thank you to the justices for allowing me to appear pro hoc vice. I appreciate it. On behalf of President-elect Biden and President-elect Vice President-elect Harris, we join fully in the arguments of Mr. Roth that the WEC guidance and administration of the election in Dana, Milwaukee complied fully with the statutory scheme in Wisconsin and produced an election that was fair, secure, and that accurately reflected the will of the voters. Your Honors, as we asked in our papers last night, we respectfully request that the court issue a decision in this matter prior to the meeting of the presidential electors on Monday at noon. We know you're acting with deliberate speed as reflected by the schedule you issued last night. We appreciate that, but I just wanted to emphasize that point. And before I turn to the substantive issues I will address, I just want to make an overarching point on behalf of my clients. And that is that Section 5.01 of the Election Code, as you all well know, establishes that the overriding purpose of the election laws in Wisconsin is to give effect to the will of the voters. And the election here was administered in a way that did just that. The voters of Wisconsin spoke very clearly when they gave President-elect Biden and Vice-president-elect Harris a margin of victory of more than 20,000 votes. And the will of the voters was reaffirmed during the exhaustive recounts conducted by the Dane and Milwaukee officials that further increased that margin of victory by some small number. And then the will of voters was again reaffirmed just yesterday when Judge Simonek affirmed the determinations of the canvassing boards based on a record that, as you all know, because you've looked at it, is robust and includes detailed findings of fact. And that ruling again confirmed that Mr. Biden and Senator Harris won this election by more than 20,000 votes. And, Your Honor, yes.
Sorry, again, mindful of the time constraints that we have today, I'm going to jump in with some questions for you. We in Wisconsin have a statute that says that ballots cast in contravention of the procedures specified under our election laws may not be counted. And ballots that are counted in contravention of the procedures specified in those provisions may not be included in the certified result of any election. One of the principal arguments that I've discerned you are making on behalf of your clients, and you are joined in those arguments by the respective clerks in Dane County and Milwaukee County, and I'm specifically looking at your supplemental brief at page 5, the purpose of a recount is to ensure that the voters, clerks, and board of canvassers followed the rules in place at the time of the election, and there's a suggestion that the rules in place were those rules as specified in guidance from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Now, I just earlier heard Mr. Roth on behalf of WEC say, well, no, of course, the statutes govern the elections. Are you suggesting that the rules are not Wisconsin law, that the rules are, in fact, what WEC says the law is?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the statute is Wisconsin law, but the WEC guidance has an important part in administering the elections and in dictating what clerks and voters will do. The WEC, by statute, has responsibility for administering the election laws under Section 5.05(2)(w), and it's the WEC that is required to educate and provide guidance to the clerks across the state. And this is important to promote uniform procedures. And the WEC has other obligations that are statutory in nature under 6.869 to keep clerks informed of the law and what processes they should follow to ensure a uniform election. So sure, by all means, the statutes are important. They are the law, but so is the WEC guidance. It's very important to how elections are administered. It's also important, Your Honor, to the reliance of voters, and voters in this case, as we know, relied significantly on the guidance that's been in place for years.
But if that guidance, Mr. Devaney, if that guidance is incorrect, and there were in fact ballots that were either cast, counted, or included in the certified results of the election, if they did not comport with law, we have Section 684 sub 2 of the Wisconsin statutes that say they're not supposed to be counted. So how can we can't get around that law, right? I mean, even if the WEC provided guidance, if it was incorrect, even if a voter or a clerk relied on that and it resulted in ballots being counted that were unlawful, this court has to apply the law, right? Not the guidance.
Certainly the court has to apply the law. And, Your Honor, as you know, I don't concede that the guidance was incorrect, but taking your question for the sake of argument, there are a few responses to it. And one is that There's a strong presumption in Wisconsin that the intent of voters should be recognized and honored. And there's a long line of case law that indicating that even if there were a mistake by an election official, even if there were inaccuracy and guidance from a voting commission or an election commission, if a voter relied on that and voted according to the law in effect of the time that he or she voted, that vote should be counted. And there's case law.
Sorry to interrupt you, but this is a really important point, I think. I might have heard you say the WEC guidance is the law, but you acknowledge it is not, right? It's just guidance.
Your Honor, the law, the starting law is the statute, but I don't mean to minimize the importance of the guidance. It's an agency that's been delegated with administering the election code, and as with any agency, it has the right to administer the statute. And so
it has to follow the statute. In other words, what I'm getting at is the WEC cannot read the statute contrary to its terms and issue guidance that is directly contradictory to a statutory provision. And I understand your argument is, well, the law was followed. But if, in fact, this court were to determine that the WEC guidance on which a voter relied was incorrect and the law was not followed, of course, we apply the law, not WEC guidance, because if we were to elevate WEC guidance to the status of law, that would allow a commission made up of six commissioners and its staff to rewrite the law in Wisconsin with respect to elections. And we can't have that, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I have two responses. One is I really want to emphasize again the importance of viewing this from the perspective of the voter and from the perspective of honoring voter intent and ensuring those who express their intent have their votes count. That is the overarching concern that's reflected in Wisconsin case law by this court going back decades. So that's my first point. My second point, which goes specifically to your question, is there is a remedy. If let's say the WEC guidance were wrong, there is a remedy for that. But the remedy is not to challenge that guidance in the context of a recount proceeding. The recount proceeding, as we articulate in our briefs, is limited to counting individual ballots and ballot envelopes on very specific criteria. It's not designed, and it's statutory language, and we need to anchor in statutory language for this proceeding, does not permit the type of broad-based challenge that is being brought here. The appropriate vehicle for challenging concerns about WEC guidance is through a declaratory judgment action or through an action under 227. It's not through a recount.
That may be, but I don't understand the president's claims to be challenging the WEC guidance. Regardless of what the guidance was, the president's challenges are based on his assertions that the law was not followed, and the president has identified those buckets, if you will, of ballots that he claims were not cast or counted in accordance with the law. So in that respect, the WEC guidance is irrelevant to this proceeding.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that characterization of their claim, because it's really a matter of semantics. What they are arguing is that the law wasn't improperly followed because clerks followed the WEC guidance. So they really are effectively challenging the WEC guidance. And my point is that the proper vehicle for doing that is before an election. Bring a declaratory judgment action. Get it resolved. Don't wait for the voters to rely on the law. And then you lose the election and you come in and you challenge these things that have been in place for, in some cases, a decade or more. And then disenfranchise 220,000 voters, only 220,000 voters in only two counties, and leave everybody else unaffected.
To that point, setting aside the relief that the president's requesting in this case, would you agree that it's important for this court to address the discrete legal issues that the president is raising with respect to whether or not the ballots were cast in accordance with Wisconsin election law?
You know, actually, Your Honor, I, of course, it's the court's ultimate decision about where it wants to go in its order, and I don't presume to tell you what you should do. But I will say this, that I think that the starting point for your analysis should be, are these issues properly before the court in a recount proceeding? And I would answer that by saying no, for the reasons I articulated. When you apply 901 and you look at the statutory language, it doesn't allow for this kind of challenge. And again, this kind of challenge should have been brought through the declaratory judgment action under 227 or original declaratory judgment action. So, and then moreover, there's the question of latches. And there was a colloquy between Justice Kurofsky and Mr. Troupas about latches and the time period that the president waited to bring these claims. And just on latches and basic notions of fairness and equitable estoppel, I think that you wouldn't even need to get to the WEC guidance and the lawfulness of them. Now, of course, you can, but I'm just telling you, from my perspective, you don't need to go there. You can resolve this case by saying these issues aren't properly before you under a recount and that the equitable principles of latches and estoppel apply here.
Well, let's look at, I'm glad you brought up latches. I don't mean to dominate the questioning here, so I invite my colleagues to jump in whenever they wish. But Chapter 9, which is part of what we're interpreting here, the president has brought a challenge to an irregularity, defect, or mistake committed during the voting or canvassing process. So could you address that part of the statute? I hear you arguing that it's not properly before us, but that's the language in Chapter 9, and I see the president's claims couched in terms of Chapter 9. I don't know how he could, in other words, I don't know how he could have brought these challenges that are based on irregularities, defects, or mistakes committed during the voting or canvassing process until the election actually took place.
Well, Your Honor, the provision in 9.01, it's 9.01B2, says that canvassing board is required to examine any absentee ballot envelopes to which an objection is made to determine whether any of the envelopes were defective. An absentee ballot is defective only if it is, quote, not witnessed, it is not signed by the voter, or the voter received the absentee ballot by fax or email, and the certificate accompanying the ballot is missing. And the idea is that in a recount, and that's what we have before us here, that the canvassing boards go through the ballots and envelopes and identify envelopes that fit those descriptions, set them aside, and have a drawdown, if necessary, to account for any ballot envelopes that were somehow inappropriate based on just those criteria. And so that is the limited purpose of a recount proceeding. And so the president's desire to challenge issues beyond that, going to his claimed irregularities, if you will, or inaccuracies in WEC guidance, are addressed not here, but again, through a declaratory judgment action, either original action or under Section 227.
But, for example, with respect to one of the claims being brought regarding the missing witness addresses, that is something that could be determined and is properly determined during the recount procedures and cases under Chapter 9, right?
Actually, Your Honor, again, that is a WEC guidance that's been in effect since 2016. It's been used in 11 statewide elections. And my position, my client's position, is that that guidance should be challenged in the context of again, a declaratory judgment proceeding that takes place before the election. So voters and clerks know if there's going to be a change in the law, that should be changed before the election, not after the election when 220,000 people, or actually it's a lot less for that particular issue, would be disenfranchised.
Okay, just not to belabor the point, but I think it's an important one, again, with respect to the witness, the missing witness information on the absentee envelopes. That's not something that could be challenged in the context of this particular election and under Chapter 9 until the election has actually taken place.
Well, I respectfully disagree. I think we're going back and forth because the guidance was in place. The practice has been in place. The president was on notice of it, and he could have challenged it. If he thought it was unlawful, he could have challenged it before the election.
The problem with that, counsel, from my perspective, is that this court recently in the SEIU decision very emphatically declared guidance documents and guidance of this nature to not be the law and to have no force and effect whatsoever. And so what we're left with is applying the statutes, not any guidance from the WEC.
Was that a question, Your Honor, or?
I'd ask you to respond to it. I did not frame it as a question. It was kind of a
I think I gave you my response earlier, which is by statute, the WEC administers elections and is required to issue guidance that ensures uniformity in election procedures across the state.
They should probably engage in rulemaking then if it is to have the force and effect of law, right?
I think that actually under the statute that advisory guidance, as they have done, is contemplated by the statute.
Counsel, could you walk through a little bit the interaction between some of these statutory provisions and just the concept of how equity, which is what Latches is, how that should interact with some of these statutory provisions that say, for example, if you don't comply with this, you can't count the votes. Help us think through that, the relationship between those.
Justice Hagedorn, the relationship is that one must begin with the concept that's established in Wisconsin statute and longstanding precedent of this court that there's a presumption the vote and intent of the voter will be counted. And that is the starting point. And so when one looks at claims that a clerk or the WEC may have erred in the guidance they issued or in how they administered the election, it's important to recognize the voters' reliance on public officials, on public statements about what the law is, and to protect the voters' reliance. And so that's the first equitable point that I would make as you consider these issues, that you have to really look from the perspective of the voter and protect that reliance. I won't give you quotes from the cases, but we have plenty of cases in our briefs that talk about that really important concept. And by the way, it's anchored also in due process. To change the guidance, to change the rules after the election and to disenfranchise voters in that circumstance is fundamentally unfair and therefore hooks into substantive due process and substantive due process violations. The second point, Justice Hagedorn, I would make in response to your question is, I just gave you an answer that was from the perspective of the voter. But I think when you think of equities, you must also look from the perspective of the challenger. And that's when we get into the issues of latches and estoppel. And the question of when President Trump benefited from these very procedures he's challenging now in 2016, both in the election and the recount, when he didn't do anything before this election until he saw that he had lost and then came forward and challenged them, the prejudice to the voters who relied on the state of the law is severe. It's if this remedy is accepted, it's outright disenfranchisement. And under basic principles of estoppel, latches, unclean hands, that affords protection for the voter. So I've done my best to answer how I think the equitable principles intertwine with the statutory question you started with, but that's how I think it works. And then while I have the floor, I'll also just add to it equal protection. And I think your question in some way triggers the equal protection question, which goes to the egregious fact in front of you, which is that the president has chosen to bring this challenge in only 2 out of 72 counties. And under Bush v. Gore, equal protection principles, it's fundamental that voters must be treated equally and afforded the same value of their vote and the same dignity and respect And by singling out the voters in Dane and Milwaukee and treating them differently from voters in other counties who follow the exact same procedures. And by the way, there are findings of fact on this that indeed these procedures were followed in counties other than Dane and Milwaukee. The findings of fact are in the high 20s and low 30s. I don't have the specifics memorized, but that is a plain violation of equal protection. And in some respects, it ties into your equity question, Justice Hagedorn.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Attorney Troupas, are you prepared for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Please go.
Your Honor,
Attorney Troupas, we left off with Democracy in the Park, what Justice Ziegler had asked about. So that the event was announced 4 weeks before the first Democracy in the Park took place. Did the president file an injunction to prevent that event from happening because it was going to be an unlawful voting procedure that you're alleging now?
No.
And did he then, there was another event, so that was back in September. That was August when it was announced. September 26th was the first one. Did he file an injunction before the second event on October 3rd?
No.
And did he ever file an injunction?
Not that I'm aware of.
He just chooses to challenge it now after he lost the election, correct?
I don't think it was a conscious choice to not do it before or not do it after. It was a obligation under the statutes, 901 sub 11, that merges all of the claims of the Trump campaign into a recount statute. As we advise the president, and as is, I think, the only view in the law of the state of Wisconsin, all items merge into the recount process. And of course, the reasons for that are that justiciable controversies are obviously posed there. We have a number of cases, they're cited in the briefs, where many issues are raised during recount proceedings, for example, illegal voters or improper voters. And there are constantly, they use a drawdown process and it's mandatory.
Again, Mr. Troupas, one illegal voter, one person who engaged in fraud at Democracy in the Park. I mean, isn't it true that the reason that your client, Donald Trump, did not file this action until after the election is because it wouldn't make any sense to do it if he had won? But now afterwards, he wants to go back and complain about things that he could have complained about 2 weeks before the election, such as Democracy in the Park, the forms that have been used for 10 years, all of these things. He had the opportunity to complain about before the election, but he chose not to. And now, after the election, he wants to disenfranchise 227,000 voters.
We do not want to disenfranchise voters. We want the law enforced. And your question implies something that I think needs to be addressed, which is that if this court were to hold that Donald Trump or any other candidate must speculate on what might happen in an election under some law that might or might not be enforced by an agency guideline that might or might not be followed, then we are headed in a very dangerous direction.
Mr. Troupas, no one is saying that he had to speculate. All these things were in existence before. I want to ask you about something you talked about before when you were talking about absentee ballot, and particularly statute 6.84 sub 1 and sub 2. And you talked about, and I agree, that voting absentee in Wisconsin is a privilege. And that statute goes on to talk about, specifically it says, the legislature finds that the privilege of voting by absentee must be carefully regulated. Then it says, to prevent the potential for fraud. Do you have any allegations of fraud to bring forward before this court?
The whole case is about fraud.
I want to know what election fraud happened on November 3rd, 2020. This is the first time I have heard you use the word fraud today, and I listened to the whole hearing yesterday and reviewed the transcript. What fraud transpired?
Let me be extraordinarily clear. And I thought I had explained this earlier, but I apologize if I did not. The statutes are in place because they presume if you do not follow these provisions, there is fraud, undue influence, and abuse. That is the assumption of the statute.
Mr. Troupas, I've got a question for you that's specifically related to the latches argument that's being made. by Mr. Biden and the clerks as well, and I believe the WEC. Mm-hmm. There's an argument that it would be unfair for this court or any court to disqualify ballots that were cast in reliance on guidance provided by the WEC. But I hear that, but then there seems to me to be an unfairness perhaps to all of the voters in the state of Wisconsin who rely on a body like the WEC to provide guidance that is in conformance with the statutes. So could you address specifically how you would ask the court, if it's considering this Latches argument, how the equities could be balanced on that point?
That's a very good question, and one we've given an awful lot of thought to in the for the president. On the one hand, the statutes are mandatory. They require the ballots be drawn down. There is no way around that language. We have not found a single case in the state's history, especially since 1984, in which a mandatory provision was not enforced exactly as it speaks. And in fact, that's just that is the statutory remedy. But Your Honor raises an interesting question, whether or not these matters can come before the court again. These are difficult cases. To have all of the factual underpinnings of a case like this at great cost and expense to everybody is rare. So we have, in fact, provided the court with substantial information that we hope the court will address as within its discretion to do so, because these are matters that are likely to recur. And we certainly do not want future elections to be carried out under these kind of circumstances without the courts clear addressing some of these claims. So while I don't believe the statute contemplates that, I do believe the statute does not prohibit it, and I think it falls within the equitable the jurisdiction of the court in all of its characteristics.
I have a follow-up to that point, Mr. Troupas. If the court were inclined to accept the Latches argument with respect to relief for your client, would it nevertheless be useful and appropriate for the court to resolve the discrete legal issues that are advanced by your client in his four claims?
Yes, it would be extraordinarily helpful.
Attorney Troupas, I heard you say earlier that there's no way to address any of these claims unless we're in the moment of when these things have been violated, but you're now asking us to address them going forward. Yet you couldn't bring those before to ask us going forward? I'm very confused by your response to that question.
Because there was no injury before, and there was no certainty that the actions would take place that, in fact, violated the law. It's precisely because of the SEIU case, for example, when we talk about WEC, that one could not have relied on its guidance, and this case would have been bounced in a moment by most circuit court judges. It's simply not right.
Okay, so Attorney Troupas, are you aware that there was actually a lawsuit filed over Democracy in the Park? This thing that you say couldn't have been brought ahead of time?
There was a lawsuit brought. It was actually brought by people trying to have it ruled legal, and the court kicked it here in Dane County.
Yeah, because everyone agreed it was legal. But in any event, it proves the point that that these actions could have been brought ahead of time, correct? I mean, you can't have it both ways.
No, I didn't say that at all. We can't speculate on possible things coming.
Okay. Democracy in the Park was announced. You knew it was coming. What do you mean speculate? These procedures were in place.
We had no injury at the time that we would have.
I want to go back to the statement that you made prior to Justice Bradley's question. You said that there was fraud in this election. I cannot believe that you are going to come forward and you are going to accuse our fellow Wisconsinites from engaging in fraud in this election. The people of Wisconsin should be thanked for exercising their civic duty, for doing what is asked of them and coming to vote. We should be thanking them. We should be thanking the poll, the election workers and the canvassers and the local officials who soldiers on through this historic election during a global pandemic. In this state, we accept the will of the voters, and they spoke. And for you to come forward today and start just throwing out allegations of fraud with zero evidence whatsoever, what is America? It is not self-governance. I'm sorry, it is self-governance. It is not governance from a king. And what you want is you want us to overturn this election so that your king can stay in power. And that is so un-American. And for you to say that anyone in Wisconsin engaged in fraud, for you to perpetuate that fallacy on the people of Wisconsin and the people of the United States and America in what has been called the most significant election in our lifetime is nothing short of shameful.
I believe that this country was founded on the principle of the rule of law. When we forget the rule of law, when we forget to enforce mandatory statutes as are involved here, we have lost our country.
Counsel, is it your position that latches could never apply to any of the claims that you're bringing here? Or do you think it could apply, it just doesn't?
In a hypothetical sense, I think that there are situations where it could apply in election law context. Yes, that's certainly true. I don't think this is one of those situations, because if there is no evidence whatsoever that the Trump campaign contemplated or considered, frankly, any of these things in advance, that in fact, if that's going to be the rule, that we're going to infer it because he's a wealthy man or it's a big election, we are headed down a very dangerous path. There's just simply no evidence that there was any knowledge or any forethought to trying to have these kinds of matters raised. And it could not have been raised. We'd have done nothing but litigation. So it's a very dangerous policy decision to force candidates to litigate these things. And as we've pointed out in our brief, it would clearly add a cost that would be unnecessary, and that would violate our First Amendment rights as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for excellent briefs and a ton of work on this case. And the argument was very, very good. It's helpful to us to bounce off of you all what may be troubling us as we try to sort through the issues that are presented. We are going to now adjourn for the day. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are adjourned.